It's the 365 Days of Astronomy podcast. Coming in 3, 2, 1.
Listening to the NASA Lunar Science Institute podcast, which highlights the latest news and information of the Moon, on the Moon, and from the Moon. It's produced by the NASA Lunar Science Institute at the Ames Research Center in Moffett Field, California.
Hi, this is Nancy Atkinson for the NASA Lunar Science Institute. Until about 5 years ago, the general consensus was that the moon was bone dry. But several different areas of research have now revealed that there is, in fact, water on and in the moon. The latest research points to water on the moon and Earth sharing a common origin. Joining me today are the authors of a new paper on this topic, Alberto Saul from Brown University and Eric Howery from the Carnegie Institution of Washington. Welcome to both of you, and thanks so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, before I ask you about your specific research, I know a lot of people are wondering kind of how the tides have changed, so to speak, on our understanding of water on the moon. For about 40 years, we thought the moon was dry, and now it seems that everywhere we look, there's evidence of water there. Does this better understanding come from better technology and spacecraft, or what's the turning point of figuring this out?
I think that there are two main issues. One, in the 70s, people tried to do this analysis, and the results that they got was that it was mainly contamination, either through solar wind implantation or earth contamination in the lab. After that, in 1984, there was a consensus about the formation of the moon, which is generated by this giant impact. And this impact is so hot and so energetic that it was believed that all the hydrogen escaped, and therefore, whatever protolunar disk that formed was essentially without hydrogen, that material aggregate to form the moon. So you have the measurements in the 70s and the consensus on the model of the moon around the early 80s. Therefore, when you have the measurements and the model that match, they said, case closed. So in 2008, we decided to revisit it because we had a much better technology with the ion probe. Eric Howery set up the technique to measure volatiles, and we were measuring volatiles on Earth's lavas at very, very high precision. And therefore, we decided why not to try to do it in moon volcanic rocks.
Well, let's talk about your research specifically. You mentioned how the leading theory of how the moon formed is from a giant impact that hit the Earth about 4.5 billion years ago. I understand you looked at samples from one of the Apollo missions.
That's right. Many of the Apollo missions brought back samples of lunar soil that, if you look at them in detail, they contain tiny spherical beads of volcanic glass. There was a lot of very careful work done by a researcher named John Delano through the 70s and 80s and other researchers, too, that was able to distinguish many different categories of this volcanic glass. And so this was a natural first place to start when we decided to see if these samples really were volatile free, or if they actually contained some signature of lunar volatiles from within the moon's interior. And so we decided to focus initially on green glass from the Apollo 15 mission and orange glass from the Apollo 17 mission.
So what hints did you find that indicated the water on Earth and the moon share a common source?
So what we used was essentially a DH ratio, deuterium to hydrogen ratio. Deuterium is an isotope of hydrogen. Essentially, it's the same electronic structure, but it has one more neutron. And because of that, they behave differently. So within the solar nebula, as the planets condense at different distance from the sun, they have a different deuterium-hydrogen ratio. And so we used that deuterium-hydrogen ratio as a fingerprint from where the water came from. And what we found is that the deuterium-hydrogen ratio that we measured in the lunar volcanic rocks was equivalent to those of carbonaceous chondrites and very, very similar to that of Earth.
So this is water that came to the Earth before the big impact 4.5 billion years ago, correct?
Right. That's where we think the water on the Earth originated from, was the accretion of these carbonaceous chondrites during the formation of the Earth. For quite some time, people have thought that this volatile inventory that we have today was added at a later stage, after the Earth was more or less fully formed, even after the giant impact that formed the Moon. But we are now coming to the conclusion that the Earth probably had this water budget before the giant impact, and that the easiest way to explain the isotopic similarity of water on the Earth and in the Moon is with the Moon being formed by the giant impact and inheriting the water that was originally present on the Earth.
Okay. We've talked several times about the late heavy bombardment. How is it possible to differentiate between, you know, that the water came prior to the impact 4.5 billion years ago rather than afterwards?
Okay, I think that we need to make, I think that this is an important difference between the Earth and how dynamic it is and plate tectonics. So anything that goes into the surface through plate tectonics, it can be brought down into the interior of the planet. So when we see lavas coming from the interior of the Earth, we don't know what the material, whether that material was sometimes in the past on the surface. So the late heavy bombardment could have an impact on Earth. However, in the case of the Moon, the Moon built up the lithosphere. It's a solid shelf. It's like a shell that essentially protects the interior, let's say it that way. It forms very, very quickly. Within the first 100 million years, that shelf will be probably 100 to 150 kilometers thick. So anything that came later, like a late heavy bombardment that came up around 500 million years after the formation of the Moon, the thickness of this shell will be so thick that nothing that hits the surface could penetrate to the interior. So whatever we see on the lavas that came from the interior of the Moon is something that happened very, very, very early in the formation of the Moon.
Are you and your fellow lunar scientists able to get a better understanding of how this water could have survived that giant impact?
Not really, unfortunately. It's a really tough problem. Most of the simulations that have been done to study the details of the impact process have reached the conclusion that the impact had enough energy to completely melt the material that entered the proto-lunar disk, and that would later form the Moon. And you see this by the evidence on the surface of the Moon that we had a global magma ocean on the Moon. This is the biggest piece of evidence in favor of this is the presence of anorthosite on the lunar highlands. It covers about 80% of the surface of the Moon. And this anorthosite is composed of the mineral plagioclase, which floats on magmas of lunar composition. And so we know that very early in the Moon's history, the surface of the Moon was covered with a global magma ocean. And so you have that on top of the fact that you have a vacuum essentially in space. The pressure on the surface of the Moon is about 15 orders of magnitude lower than the pressure on the surface of the Earth, and the Moon doesn't have enough gravity to retain an atmosphere. So all of these things put together end up creating an environment on the Moon that's very hostile to the retention of water. So there's no reason to think that you know, we would have any water on the Moon, let alone quantities of water that we're seeing. So it's a really, really tricky problem.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about specifically the equipment that you use to make your determinations?
So the equipment that we used is called a NanoSims ion microprobe. And what this instrument does is it creates an accelerated particle beam of cesium ions that is focused to a probe diameter of 1 micron or less. And this probe sputters material from the surface of the sample that is sitting in the instrument. And so what we do is we take the lunar volcanic glasses and melt inclusions. We polish them to expose their interior so that we're not analyzing any sort of a contaminated surface. We're actually exposing the interior. And then it's this material that gets sputtered by the impacting cesium beam. The material that's sputtered off of the sample, some of it is converted to ions, and those ions go into a mass spectrometer. And the mass spectrometer that we have on the NanoSims is composed of 7 detectors so that we can analyze 7 different species simultaneously. And this instrument has a really, really very low detection limit for the abundance of water. It's on the order of 1 ppm or less, and also a very small detection limit for carbon, around 100 parts per billion or better. And so this was an ideal instrument to not only measure the amount of water that we have in the lunar volcanic glasses, but also the hydrogen isotope composition of that water.
Well, I know there's always more research that people want to do on a topic. What do, plans do you have to do further research in this area?
There are a couple of things. One is to confirm the values by analyzing many other samples from the moon and getting consistent value all over the moon. That will give us a much better sense that what we are saying is correct. I think that that's the first order of things that we want to do. The second thing that we want to do is we would like to begin to analyze material from the asteroidal belt, different type of meteorites. And with the special resolution that the NanoSim has, that you can analyze very, very, very small pieces of this material, then it's an advantage for us.
Okay. Is there anything else about this research that you think is important for people to know?
I think that there is, now it's a little bit of an extrapolation, but if you think this way, if you think that what you see on the moon is essentially a fossilized record of something that happened very, very early in the history of the solar system, and we see that the concentration of water in the moon is, an order of 5 to 10 maybe lower than on Earth. And you see this fingerprint that we talked that is the DH ratio that are very similar to the Earth, but the moon representing something that happened 4.5 billion years ago, and the Earth is deintegrated over time since its formation until now. That is telling us that the budget of water and the DH ratio of water on Earth did not significantly change after the formation of the moon. So that's an extrapolation that we can make from our research, although more work needed to be done, but that's the first inference that we can make.
I think there are also some really important implications for future sample return missions that are planned or in the planning stages. One of the ones that is planned to launch in a few years is the OSIRIS-REx mission, which will recover material from an asteroid with an Earth-crossing orbit. This asteroid has been identified to be carbonaceous chondrite-like in composition. And so if you want to study the relationship between the Earth, the Moon, and carbonaceous chondrites, the best place to go is the horse's mouth, to actually obtain a sample of a carbonaceous chondrite that is on an Earth-crossing orbit. So this is a really important mission from that aspect. Another one is that, you know, we're using the composition of water in volcanic glasses to say something about the mantle of the moon, the moon's interior. And we know that there are several sample return missions in the planning process that are proposing to go back to the moon to return samples from very deep impact craters that might have excavated the lunar mantle directly and might be able to return direct samples of the moon's mantle. That would be a really important piece of evidence as well. And then if we want to think, in the decadal time frame, obtaining samples like the ones we've studied, these volcanic glasses, they've been mapped from several different objects in the solar system. And so it would be great to, for example, obtain samples from the surface of a Martian moon, Phobos or Deimos, or even Mercury, if the engineers could figure out a way to get a sample return back from the surface of Mercury, that would be fantastic. But these types of samples are really the only way that you can directly say something about the budget of water in the interior of a planetary object. And then finally, we have, it's important to make a distinction here between the moon's water that's on the surface and the budget of water in its interior. We're strictly saying things that are mainly related to the water that's dissolved in the lunar interior. The water that we map on the lunar surface could have a very different origin from the water that we're looking at.
Okay. Well, that sounds great. And those all sound like really great scientific missions that I hope we see in the future. Alberto Saul and Eric Howery, Thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to hearing more from you later.
Thank you.
To find out more about this topic, visit our website at www.lunarscience.nasa.gov. Any opinions expressed are those of the individual and do not necessarily reflect the opinion of NASA or the NASA Lunar Science Institute. This podcast is produced for educational and information purposes only. On behalf of the NASA Lunar Science Institute, thanks for listening.
You are listening to the IYA 365 Days of Astronomy podcast.
The 365 Days of Astronomy podcast is produced by Astrosphere New Media Association. Audio post-production by Preston Gibson. Bandwidth donated by Libsyn.com and Wizard Media. Web design by Clockwork Active Media Systems. You may reproduce and distribute this audio for non-commercial purposes. Please consider supporting the podcast with a few dollars or euros. Visit us on the web at 365daysofastronomy.org or email us at info@365daysofastronomy.org. Until tomorrow, goodbye.